relations with other species and their features, plus anything that can be obtained by traveling from that broad front, either just in the course of nature, without human manipulation, or with the help of such artificial cranes as the techniques of traditional animal breeding, and for that matter, surgery, or via the fancy new vehicles of genetic engineering. After all, we human beings and all our tricks are just another product of the contemporary biosphere. Thus, it is biologically possible for you to have a fresh turkey dinner on Christmas Day 2001, if, and only if, at least one instantiated turkey genome has produced the requisite phenotypic effects in time for dinner. It is biologically possible for you to ride a pteranodon before you die if, and only if, Jurassic Parkish technology permits that sort of genome to get expressed in time. No matter how we set these travel parameters, the resulting notion of biological possibility will have an important property. Some things will be more possible than others, that is, nearer in the multidimensional search space, and more accessible, easier to get to. Things that would have been viewed as biological impossibilities just a few years ago, such as plants that glowed in the dark in virtue of having firefly genes in them, are now not only possible, but actual. Are 21st century dinosaurs possible? Well, the vehicles for getting there from here have been developed to the point where we can at least tell a cracking good story, one requiring remarkably little poetic license. There is a portion of the Library of Mendel through which the Tree of Life stopped meandering about 60 million years ago. What rules govern travel through this space? What rules or laws constrain the relations between genomes and their phenotypic products? So far, all we have acknowledged are logical or mathematical necessities on the one hand, and the laws of physics on the other. That is, we have proceeded as if we knew what both logical possibility and mere physical possibility were. These are difficult and controversial issues, but we may consider them clamped. We simply assume some fixed version of those varieties of possibility and necessity, and then develop our restricted notion of biological possibility in terms of it. The law of large numbers and the law of gravity, for instance, are both deemed to hold unreservedly and timelessly over the space. Clamping physical law lets us say flat out, for instance, that all the different genomes are physically possible, because chemistry says they are all stable if encountered. Keeping logic and physics and chemistry clamped, we could choose a different starting point. We could choose some moment on Earth 5 billion years ago and consider what was biologically possible then. Not much, because before tigers could become possible on Earth, eukaryotes and then plants producing atmospheric oxygen in large quantities, and many other things, had to become actual. With hindsight, we can say that tigers were in fact possible all along, if distant and extremely improbable. One of the virtues of this way of thinking of possibility is that it joins forces with probability, thus permitting us to trade in flat all-or-nothing claims about possibility for claims about relative distance, which is what matters for most purposes. The all-or-nothing claims of biological possibility were all but impossible, to adjudicate. So this is no loss. As we discussed in our exploration of the Library of Babel, it doesn't make much difference what our verdict is about whether it is possible in principle to find some particular volume in that vast space. What matters is what is practically possible, in one or another sense of practical. Take your pick. This is certainly not a standard definition of possibility, or even a standard sort of definition of possibility. The idea that some things might be more possible than others, or more possible from over here than from over there, is at odds with one standard understanding of the term, and some philosophical critics might say that this is simply not a definition of possibility, whatever it is. Some other philosophers have defended views of comparative possibility. See especially Lewis, 1986, pages 10 and the pages that follow. But I don't want to fight over it. If this is not an account of possibility, so be it. It is, then, a proposed replacement for a definition of possibility. Perhaps, after all, we don't need the concept of biological possibility with its required all-or-nothing application for any serious investigative purpose. Perhaps degree of accessibility in the space of the Library of Mendel is all we need, and is, in fact, a better concept than any all-or-nothing version could be. It would be nice, for instance, to have some way of ranking the following in terms of biological possibility: 10-pound tomatoes, aquatic dogs, flying horses, flying trees. That will not be enough to satisfy many philosophers, and their objections are serious. Briefly considering them will at least make it clearer what I am claiming and what I am not claiming. First of all, isn't there something viciously circular about defining possibility in terms of accessibility? Doesn't the latter term just reintroduce the former in its suffix, and still undefined? Well, not quite. It does leave some definitely unfinished business, which I will simply acknowledge before moving on. We have supposed that we are holding some concept or other of physical possibility clamped for the time being. Our idea of accessibility presupposes that this physical possibility, whatever it is, leaves us some elbow room, some openness of pathways, not just a single pathway in the space. In other words, we are taking on the assumption that nothing stops us from going down any of the pathways that are open so far as physics is concerned. Quine's questions, at the head of this chapter, invited us to worry about whether we could count non-actual possible objects. One of the virtues of the proposed treatment of biological possibility is that, thanks to its arbitrary formal system, the system arbitrarily imposed on us by nature, at least in our neck of the woods, we can count the different non-actual possible genomes. They are vast, but finite in number, and no two are exactly alike. By definition, genomes are distinct if they fail to share a nucleotide at any one of several billion loci. In what sense are the non-actual genomes really possible? Only in this sense. If they were formed, they'd be stable. But whether or not any conspiracy of events could lead to their being formed is another matter, to be addressed in terms of accessibility from one location or another. Most of the genomes in this set of stable possibilities will never be formed, we can be sure, since the heat death of the universe will overtake the building process before it has made a sizable dent in the space. Two other objections to this proposal about biological possibility cry out to be heard. First, isn't it outrageously gene-centered in anchoring all considerations of biological possibility to the accessibility of one genome or another in the Library of Mendel? Our proposed treatment of biological possibility flatly ignores, and hence implicitly rules impossible, creatures that are not endpoints of some branch of the tree of life that has already taken us as far as we are today. But that just is the grand unification of biology that Darwin discovered. Unless you harbor fantasies about spontaneous creation of new life forms by special creation or the philosopher's secular version, cosmic coincidence, you accept that every feature of the biosphere is one fruit or another of the tree of life, or, If not our tree of life, some other tree of life with its own accessibility relations. No man is an island, John Donne proclaims, and Charles Darwin adds that neither is any clam or tulip. Every possible living thing is connected by isthmuses of descent to all other living things. Notice that this doctrine rules in whatever marvels technology can produce in the future, provided, as we have already noted, that technologists themselves and their tools and methods are firmly located on the tree of life. It is a small further step to rule in life forms from outer space, provided they too are the products of a tree of life rooted, as ours is, in some non-miraculous physical ground. This topic will be explored in Chapter 7. Second, why should we treat biological possibility so differently from physical possibility? If we assume that laws of physics fix the limits of physical possibility, why shouldn't we attempt to define biological possibility in terms of laws of biology? We will turn to an examination of physical laws and physical necessity in Chapter 7, but in the meantime, the difference appears large. Many biologists and philosophers of science have maintained that there are biological laws. Doesn't the proposed definition rule them out? Or does it declare them superfluous? It doesn't rule them out. It permits someone to argue for the dominion of some law of biology over the space of the Library of Mendel, but it does put a difficult burden of proof on anyone who thinks that there are laws of biology over and above the laws of mathematics and physics. Consider the fate of Dolo's Law, for instance. Dolo's Law states that evolution is irreversible, but there is no reason why general trends in evolution shouldn't be reversed. If there is a trend towards large antlers for a while in evolution, there can easily be a subsequent trend towards smaller antlers again. Dolo's Law is really just a statement about the statistical improbability of following exactly the same evolutionary trajectory twice, or indeed any particular trajectory in either direction. A single mutational step can easily be reversed. But for larger numbers of mutational steps, the mathematical space of all possible trajectories is so vast that the chance of two trajectories ever arriving at the same point becomes vanishingly small. There is nothing mysterious or mystical about Dolo's Law, nor is it something that we go out and test in nature. It follows simply from the elementary laws of probability. Dawkins, 1986A, page 94. There is no shortage of candidates for the role of irreducible biological law. For instance, many have argued that there are developmental laws or laws of form that constrain the relation between genotype and phenotype. In due course, we will consider their status, but already we can locate at least some of the most salient constraints on biological possibility as not laws of biology, but just inescapable features of the geometry of design space, like Dolo's Law, or the Hardy-Weinberg Law of gene frequency, which is another application of probability theory, pure and simple. Take the case of the horned birds. As Maynard Smith notes, there aren't any, and we don't know why. Might it be because they are ruled out by a biological law? Are horned birds flat impossible? Would they have to be inviable in any and all possible environments? Or is there simply no path at all from here to there because of restrictions on the genome reading process? As we have already noted, we should be impressed by the severe restrictions encountered by this process, but we should not be carried away. Those restrictions may not be a universal feature, but a temporally and spatially local feature, analogous to what Seymour Papert has dubbed the QWERTY phenomenon in the culture of computers and keyboards. The top row of alphabetic keys of the standard typewriter reads QWERTY. For me, this symbolizes the way in which technology can all too often serve not as a force for progress, but for keeping things stuck. The QWERTY arrangement has no rational explanation, only a historical one. It was introduced in response to a problem in the early days of the typewriter. The keys used to jam. The idea was to minimize the collision problem by separating those keys that followed one another frequently. Once adopted, it resulted in many millions of typewriters and, the social cost of change, mounted with the vested interest created by the fact that so many fingers now knew how to follow the QWERTY keyboard. QWERTY has stayed on, despite the existence of other, more rational systems. Papert, 1980, page 33. The imperious restrictions we encounter inside the Library of Mendel may look like universal laws of nature from our myopic perspective, but from a different perspective, they may appear to count as merely local conditions with historical explanations. If so, then a restricted concept of biological possibility is the sort we want. The ideal of a universal concept of biological possibility will be misguided. But as I have already allowed, this does not rule out biological laws. It merely sets the burden of proof for those who want to propose any. And in the meantime, it gives us a framework for describing large and important classes of regularity we discover in the patterns in our biosphere. Chapter 5. Biological possibility is best seen in terms of accessibility, from some stipulated location, in the Library of Mendel, the logical space of all genomes. This concept of possibility treats the connectedness of the tree of life as a fundamental feature of biology, while leaving it open that there may also be biological laws that will also constrain accessibility. Chapter 6. The R&D done by natural selection in the course of creating actual trajectories in the vast space of possibilities can be measured to some extent. Among the important features of this search space are the solutions to problems that are perennially attractive and, hence, predictable, like forced moves in chess. This explains some of our intuitions about originality, discovery, and invention, and also clarifies the logic of Darwinian inference about the past. There is a single, unified design space in which the processes of both biological and human creativity make their tracks, using similar methods. Chapter 6. Threads of Actuality in Design Space. 1. Drifting and lifting through design space. The actual animals that have ever lived on Earth are a tiny subset of the theoretical animals that could exist. These real animals are the products of a very small number of evolutionary trajectories through genetic space. The vast majority of theoretical trajectories through animal space give rise to impossible monsters. Real animals are dotted around here and there among the hypothetical monsters, each perched in its own unique place in genetic hyperspace. Each real animal is surrounded by a little cluster of neighbors, most of whom have never existed, but a few of whom are its ancestors, its descendants, and its cousins. Richard Dawkins, 1986A, page 73. The actual genomes that have ever existed are a vanishingly small subset of the combinatorially possible genomes, just as the actual books in the world's libraries are a vanishingly small subset of the books in the imaginary Library of Babel. As we survey the Library of Babel, we may be struck by how hard it is to specify a category of books that isn't vast in membership, however vanishingly small it is in relation to the whole. The set of books, composed entirely of grammatical English sentences, is a vast but vanishing subset. And the set of readable, sense-making books is a vast but vanishing subset of it. Vanishingly hidden in that subset is the vast set of books about people named Charles. And within that set, though vanishingly hard to find, is the vast set of books purporting to tell the truth about Charles Darwin. And a vast but vanishing subset of these consists of books composed entirely in limericks. So it goes. The number of actual books about Charles Darwin is a huge number, but not a vast number. And we won't get down to that set as of today or as of the year 3000 AD, by just piling on the restricting adjectives in this fashion. To get to the actual books, we have to turn to the historical process that created them, in all its grubby particularity. The same is true of the actual organisms or their actual genomes. We don't need laws of biology to prevent most of the physical possibilities from becoming actualities. Sheer absence of opportunity will account for most of them. The only reason all your non-actual aunts and uncles never came into existence is that your grandparents didn't have time or energy, to say nothing of the inclination, to create more than a few of the nearby genomes. Among the many non-actual possibilities, some are or were more possible than others. That is, their appearance was more probable than the appearance of others, simply because they were neighbors of actual genomes, only a few choices away in the random zipping up process that puts together the new DNA volume from the parent drafts, or only one or a few random typos away in the great copying process. Why didn't the near misses happen? No reason. They just didn't happen to happen. And then, as the actual genomes that did happen to happen began to move away from the locations in design space of the near misses, their probability of ever happening grew smaller. They were so close to becoming actual, and then their moment passed. Will they get another chance? It is possible, but vastly improbable, given the vast size of the space in which they reside. But what forces, if any, bend the paths of actuality farther and farther away from their locations? The motion that occurs if there are no forces at all is called random genetic drift. You might think that drift, being random, would always tend to cancel itself out, bringing the path back to the same genomes again and again in the absence of any selective forces. But the very fact that there is only limited sampling in the huge space, which has a million dimensions, remember, leads inevitably to the accumulation of distance between actual genomes, the upshot of Dolo's law. Darwin's central claim is that when the force of natural selection is imposed on this random meandering, in addition to drifting, there is lifting. Any motion in design space can be measured, but the motion of random drift is, intuitively, merely sideways. It doesn't get us anywhere important. Considered as R&D work, it is idle, leading to the accumulation of mere typographical change, but not to the accumulation of design. In fact, it is worse than that, for most mutations, typos, will be neutral, and most of the typos that aren't neutral will be deleterious. In the absence of natural selection, the drift is inexorably downward in design space. The situation in the Library of Mendel is thus precisely like the situation in the Library of Babel. Most typographical changes to Moby Dick can be supposed to be practically neutral, as good as invisible to most readers. Of the few that make a difference, most will do damage to the text, making it a worse, less coherent, less comprehensible tale. Consider as an exercise, however, the version of Peter de Vries's game, in which the object is to improve a text by a single typographical change. It is not impossible, but far from easy. These intuitions about getting somewhere important, about design improvement, about rising in design space, are powerful and familiar. But are they reliable? Are they perhaps just a confusing legacy of the pre-Darwinian vision of design coming down from a handicrafter god? What is the relationship between the ideas of design and progress? There is no fixed agreement among evolutionary theorists about this. Some biologists are fastidious, going to great lengths to avoid allusions to design or function in their own work, while others build their whole careers around the functional analysis of this or that, an organ, patterns of food gathering, reproductive strategies, etc. Some biologists think you can speak of design or function without committing yourself to any dubious doctrine about progress. Others are not so sure. Did Darwin deal a death blow to teleology, as Marx exclaimed? Or did he show how the rational meaning of the natural sciences was to be empirically explained, as Marx went right on to exclaim, thereby making a safe home in science for functional or teleological discussion? Is design something that can be measured, even indirectly and imperfectly? Curiously enough, skepticism about this prospect actually undercuts the most potent source of skepticism about Darwinism. As I pointed out in Chapter 3, the most powerful challenges to Darwinism have always taken this form. Are Darwinian mechanisms powerful enough or efficient enough to have done all that work in the time available? All what work? If the question concerned mere sideways drifting in the typographical space of possible genomes, the answer would be obvious and uncontroversial. Yes, there has been much more than enough time. The speed at which random drift should accumulate mere typographical distance can be calculated, giving us a sort of posted speed limit. And both theory and observation agree that actual evolution happens much slower than that. The products that are impressive to the skeptics are not the diverse DNA strings in themselves, but the amazingly intricate, complex, and well-designed organisms whose genomes those strings are. No analysis of the genomes in isolation of the organisms they create could yield the dimension we are looking for. It would be like trying to define the difference between a good novel and a great novel in terms of the relative frequencies of the alphabetical characters in them. We have to look at the whole organism, in its environment, to get any purchase on the issue. As William Paley saw, what is truly impressive is the bounty of astonishingly ingenious and smoothly functioning arrangements of matter that go to compose living things. And when we turn to examining the organism, we find again that no mere tabulation of the items composing it is going to give us what we want. What could be the relationship between amounts of complexity and amounts of design? Less is more, said the architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. Consider the famous British Seagull outboard motor, a triumph of simplicity, a design that honors the principle that what isn't there can't break. We want to be able to acknowledge, and even measure if possible, the design excellence manifest in the right sort of simplicity. But what is the right sort? Or what is the right sort of occasion for simplicity? Not every occasion. Sometimes more is more, and of course what makes the British Seagull so wonderful is that it is such an elegant marriage of complexity and simplicity. Nobody has quite such high regard, nor should they, for a paddle. We can begin to get a clear view of this if we think about convergent evolution and the occasions on which it occurs. And, as is so often the case, choosing extreme and imaginary examples is a good way of focusing on what counts. In this instance, a favorite extreme case to consider is extraterrestrial life, and of course it may someday soon be turned from fantasy into fact if SETI, the ongoing search for extraterrestrial intelligence, finds anything. If life on Earth is massively contingent, if its mere occurrence in any form at all is a happy accident, then what can we say, if anything, about life on other planets in the universe? We can lay down some conditions with confidence approaching certainty. These, at first, appear to fall into two contrasting groups: necessities and what we might call obvious optimalities. Let's consider a necessity first. Life anywhere would consist of entities with autonomous metabolisms. Some people would say this is true by definition. By defining life in this way, they can exclude the viruses as living forms while keeping the bacteria in the charmed circle. There may be good reasons for such a definitional fiat, but I think we see more clearly the importance of autonomous metabolism if we see it as a deep, if not utterly necessary, condition for the sort of complexity that is needed to fend off the gnawing effects of the second law of thermodynamics. All complex macromolecular structures tend to break down over time. So, unless a system is an open system, capable of taking in fresh materials and replenishing itself, it will tend to have a short career. The question, what does it live on, might get wildly different answers on different planets. But it does not betray a geocentric, let alone anthropocentric, assumption. What about vision? We know that eyes have evolved independently many times, but vision is certainly not a necessity on Earth, since plants get along fine without it. A strong case can be made, however, that if an organism is going to further its metabolic projects by locomoting, and if the medium in which the locomoting takes place is transparent or translucent and amply supplied by ambient light, then since locomoting works much better at furthering self-protective, metabolic, and reproductive aims, if the mover is guided by information about distal objects, and since such information can be garnered in a high-fidelity, low-cost fashion by vision, vision is a very good bet. So we would not be surprised to find that locomoting organisms on other planets with transparent atmospheres had eyes. Eyes are an obviously good solution to a very general problem that would often be encountered by moving metabolizers. Eyes may not always be available, of course, for QWERTY reasons, but they are obviously rational solutions to this highly abstract design problem. 2. Forced moves in the game of design. Now that we have encountered this appeal to what is obviously rational under some general set of circumstances, we can look back and see that our case of necessity, having an autonomous metabolism, can be recast as simply the only acceptable solution to the most general design problem of life. If you want to live, you got to eat. In chess, when there is only one way of staving off disaster, it is called a forced move. Such a move is not forced by the rules of chess, and certainly not by the laws of physics. You can always kick the table over and run away. But by what Hume might call a dictate of reason, it is simply dead obvious that there is one and only one solution, as anybody with an ounce of wit can plainly see. Any alternatives are immediately suicidal. In addition to having an autonomous metabolism, any organism must also have a more or less definite boundary, distinguishing itself from everything else. This condition, too, has an obvious and compelling rationale. As soon as something gets into the business of self-preservation, boundaries become important. For if you are setting out to preserve yourself, you don't want to squander effort trying to preserve the whole world. You draw the line. Dennett, 1991A, page 174. We would also expect the locomoting organisms on an alien planet to have efficiently shaped boundaries, like those of organisms on Earth. Why? Why on Earth? If cost were no object, one might have no regard for streamlining in organisms that move through a relatively dense fluid, such as water. But cost is always an object. The second law of thermodynamics guarantees that. So at least some biological necessities may be recast as obvious solutions to the most general problems as forced moves in design space. These are cases in which, for one reason or another, there is only one way things can be done. But reasons can be deep or shallow. The deep reasons are the constraints of the laws of physics, such as the second law of thermodynamics, or the laws of mathematics, or logic. The shallow reasons are just historical. There used to be two or more ways this problem might be solved, but now that some ancient historical accident has set us off down one particular path, only one way is remotely available. It has become a virtual necessity, a necessity for all practical purposes, given the cards that have been dealt. The other options are no longer really options at all. This marriage of chance and necessity is a hallmark of biological regularities. People often want to ask, is it merely a massively contingent fact that circumstances are as they are? Or can we read some deep necessity into them? The answer almost always is both. But note that the type of necessity that fits so well with the chance of random, blind generation is the necessity of reason. It is an inescapably teleological variety of necessity, the dictate of what Aristotle called practical reasoning and what Kant called a hypothetical imperative. If you want to achieve goal G, then this is what you must do given the circumstances. The more universal the circumstances, the more universal the necessity. That is why we would not be surprised to find that the living things on other planets included locomotors with eyes, and why we would be more than surprised, utterly dumbfounded, if we found things scurrying around on various projects but lacking any metabolic processes. But now, let us consider the difference between the similarities that would surprise us and the similarities that would not. Suppose SETI struck it rich and established communication with intelligent beings on another planet. We would not be surprised to find that they understood and used the same arithmetic that we do. Why not? Because arithmetic is right. Might there not be different kinds of arithmetic-like systems, all equally good? Marvin Minsky, one of the founders of artificial intelligence, has explored this curious question, and his ingeniously reasoned answer is no. In Why Intelligent Aliens Will Be Intelligible, he offers grounds for believing in something he calls the sparseness principle. Whenever two relatively simple processes have products which are similar, those products are likely to be completely identical. Exclamation point. Minsky, 1985A, page 119. Exclamation point in the original. Consider the set of all possible processes, which Minsky interprets a la the Library of Babel as all permutations of all possible computers. Any computer can be identified abstractly as one Turing machine or another, and these can be given unique identifying numbers and then put in numerical order, just like the alphabetical order in the Library of Babel. Except for a vanishing few, the vast majority of these processes do scarcely anything at all. So if you find two that do something similar and worth noticing, they are almost bound to be one and the same process at some level of analysis. Minsky, page 122, applies the principle to arithmetic. From all this, I conclude that any entity who searches through the simplest processes will soon find fragments which do not merely resemble arithmetic, but are arithmetic. It is not a matter of inventiveness or imagination, only a fact about the geography of the universe of computation, a world far more constrained than that of real things. The point is clearly not restricted to arithmetic, but to all necessary truths, what philosophers since Plato have called a priori knowledge. As Minsky, page 119, says, "We can expect certain a priori structures to appear almost always whenever a computation system evolves by selection from a universe of possible processes. It has often been pointed out that Plato's curious theory of reincarnation and reminiscence, which he offers as an explanation of the source of our a priori knowledge, bears a striking resemblance to Darwin's theory. And this resemblance is particularly striking from our current vantage point. Darwin himself famously noted the resemblance in a remark in one of his notebooks, commenting on the claim that Plato thought our necessary ideas arise from the pre-existence of the soul. Darwin wrote, "Read Monkeys for Pre-existence." Desmond and Moore, 1991, page 263. We would not be surprised then to find that extraterrestrials had the same unshakable grip on 2 plus 2 equals 4 and its kin that we do. But we would be surprised, wouldn't we, if we found them using the decimal system for expressing their truths of arithmetic. We are inclined to believe that our fondness for it is something of a historical accident, derived from counting on our 2 5-digit hands. But suppose they too have a pair of hands, each with 5 subunits. The solution of using whatever you've got to count on is a fairly obvious one, if not quite in the forced move category. It would not be particularly surprising to find that our aliens had a pair of prehensile appendages, considering the good reasons there are for bodily symmetry, and the frequency of problems that require one thing to be manipulated relative to another. But that there should be 5 subunits on each appendage looks like a QWERTY phenomenon that has been deeply rooted for hundreds of millions of years, a mere historical happenstance that has restricted our options, but should not be expected to have restricted theirs. But perhaps we underestimate the rightness, the rationality of having 5 subunits. For reasons we have not yet fathomed, it may be a good idea in general and not merely something we are stuck with. Then it would not be amazing after all to find that our interlocutors from outer space had converged on the same good idea and counted in tens, hundreds, and thousands. We would be flabbergasted, however, to find them using the very symbols we use, the so-called Arabic numerals 1, 2, 3. We know that right here on Earth there are perfectly fine alternatives, such as the Arabic numerals Wahed, Isnani, Therasa, Erbara, as well as some not-so-viable alternatives, such as Roman numerals I, II, III, IV. If we found the inhabitants of another planet using our Arabic numerals, we would be quite sure that it was no coincidence. There had to be a historical connection. Why? Because the space of possible numeral shapes in which there is no reason for choosing one over the other is vast. The likelihood of 2 independent searches ending up in the same place is vanishing. Students often have a hard time keeping clear about the distinction between numbers and numerals. Numbers are the abstract, Platonic objects that numerals are the names of. The Arabic numeral 4 and the Roman numeral IV are simply different names for one and the same thing, the number 4. I can't talk about the number without naming it in one way or another, any more than I can talk about Clinton without using some word or words that refer to him. But Clinton is a man, not a word. And numbers aren't symbols either. Numerals are. Here is a vivid way of seeing the importance of the distinction between numbers and numerals. We have just observed that it would not be surprising at all to find that extraterrestrials used the same numbers we do, but simply incredible if they used the same numerals. In a vast space of possibilities, the odds of a similarity between 2 independently chosen elements is vanishing unless there is a reason. There is, for numbers, arithmetic is true and variations on arithmetic aren't, and there isn't, for numerals, the symbol section sign or double S would function exactly as well as the symbol 5 as a name for the number that follows 4. Suppose we found the extraterrestrials like us using the decimal system for most informal purposes, but converting to binary arithmetic when doing computation with the aid of mechanical prosthetic devices, computers. Their use of 0 and 1 in their computers, supposing they had invented computers, would not surprise us, since there are good engineering reasons for adopting the binary system. And though these reasons are not dead obvious, they are probably within striking distance for average type thinkers. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to appreciate the virtues of binary. In general, we would expect them to have discovered many of the various ways things have of being the right way. Wherever there are many different ways of skinning a cat, and none is much better than any other, our surprise that they are doing it our way will be proportional to how many different ways we think there are. Notice that even when we are contemplating some vast number of equivalent ways, a value judgment is implicit. For us to recognize items as things falling into one of these vast sets, they have to be seen as equally good ways, as ways of performing the function X. Functionalistic thinking is simply inescapable in this sort of inquiry. You can't even enumerate the possibilities without presupposing a concept of function. Now we can see that even our deliberately antiseptic formalization of the Library of Mendel invoked functional presuppositions. We can't identify something as a possible genome without thinking of genomes as things that might serve a particular function within a reproductive system. So there turn out to be general principles of practical reasoning, including, in more modern dress, cost-benefit analysis, that can be relied upon to impose themselves on all life forms anywhere. We can argue about particular cases, but not about the applicability in general of the principles. Are such design features as bilateral symmetry in locomotors, or mouth at the bow end, to be explained as largely a matter of historical contingency, or largely a matter of practical wisdom? The only issues to debate or investigate are their relative contributions, and the historical order in which the contributions were made. Recall that in the actual QWERTY phenomenon, there was a perfectly good engineering reason for the initial choice. It was just a reason whose supporting circumstances had long ago lapsed. Design work, lifting, can now be characterized as the work of discovering good ways of solving problems that arise. Some problems are given at the outset, in all environments, under all conditions, to all species. Further problems are then created by the initial attempts at solution made by different species faced with the first problems. Some of these subsidiary problems are created by the other species of organisms, who must make a living too, and other subsidiary problems are created by a species' own solutions to its own problems. For instance, now that one has decided, by flipping a coin perhaps, to search for solutions in this area, one is stuck with problem B instead of problem A, which poses subproblems P, Q, and R instead of subproblems X, Y, and Z, and so forth. Should we personify a species in this way and treat it as an agent or practical reasoner? Scholl, 1990, Dennett, 1990A. Alternatively, we may choose to think of species as perfectly mindless non-agents and put the rationale in the process of natural selection itself, perhaps jocularly personified as Mother Nature. Remember Francis Crick's quip about evolutions being cleverer than you are. Or we may choose to shrink from these vivid modes of expression altogether. But the analyses we do will have the same logic in any case. This is what lies behind our intuition that design work is somehow intellectual work, Design work is discernible in the otherwise uninterpretable typography of shifting genomes only if we start imposing reasons on it. In earlier work, I characterized these as free-floating rationales, a term that has apparently induced terror or nausea in many otherwise well-disposed readers. Bear with me. I will soon provide some more palatable ways of making these points. So Paley was right in saying not just that design was a wonderful thing to explain, but also that design took intelligence. All he missed, and Darwin provided, was the idea that this intelligence could be broken into bits so tiny and stupid that they didn't count as intelligence at all, and then distributed through space and time in a gigantic, connected network of algorithmic process. The work must get done. But which work gets done is largely a matter of chance, since chance helps determine which problems and subproblems get addressed by the machinery. Whenever we find a problem solved, we can ask, who or what did the work? Where and when? Has a solution been worked out locally or long ago? Or was it somehow borrowed or stolen from some other branch of the tree? If it exhibits peculiarities that could only have arisen in the course of solving the subproblems in some apparently remote branch of the tree that grows in design space, then barring a miracle or a coincidence too cosmic to credit, there must be a copying event of some kind that moved that completed design work to its new location. There is no single summit in design space, nor a single staircase or ladder with calibrated steps. So we cannot expect to find a scale for comparing amounts of design work across distant developing branches. Thanks to the vagaries and digressions of different methods adopted, something that is in some sense just one problem can have both hard and easy solutions, requiring more or less work. There is a famous story about the mathematician and physicist and co-inventor of the computer, John von Neumann, who was legendary for his lightning capacity to do prodigious calculations in his head. Like most famous stories, this one has many versions, of which I choose the one that best makes the point I am pursuing. One day, a colleague approached him with a puzzle that had two paths to solution: a laborious, complicated calculation, and an elegant aha-type solution. This colleague had a theory. In such a case, mathematicians work out the laborious solution while the lazier but smarter physicists pause and find the quick and easy solution. Which solution would von Neumann find? You know the sort of puzzle. Two trains, 100 miles apart, are approaching each other on the same track, one going 30 miles per hour, the other going 20 miles per hour. A bird flying 120 miles per hour starts at train A when they are 100 miles apart, flies to train B, turns around and flies back to the approaching train A, and so forth until the trains collide. How far has the bird flown when the collision occurs? 240 miles, von Neumann answered almost instantly. Darn, replied his colleague. I predicted you'd do it the hard way. Aye, von Neumann cried in embarrassment, smiting his forehead. There's an easy way? Hint. How long till the trains collide? Eyes are the standard example of a problem that has been solved many times, but eyes that may look just the same and see just the same may have been achieved by R&D projects that involved different amounts of work, thanks to the historical peculiarities of the difficulties encountered along the way. And the creatures that don't have eyes at all are neither better nor worse on any absolute scale of design. Their lineage has just never been given this problem to solve. It is this same variability in luck in the various lineages that makes it impossible to define a single Archimedean point from which global progress could be measured. Is it progress when you have to work an extra job to pay for the high-priced mechanic you have to hire to fix your car when it breaks, Because it is too complex for you to fix in the way you used to fix your old clunker? Who is to say? Some lineages get trapped in, or are lucky enough to wander into, take your pick, a path in design space in which complexity begets complexity, in an arms race of competitive design. Others are fortunate enough, or unfortunate enough, take your pick, to have hit upon a relatively simple solution to life's problems at the outset, and, having nailed it a billion years ago, have had nothing much to do in the way of design work ever since. We human beings, complicated creatures that we are, tend to appreciate complexity, but that may well be just an aesthetic preference that goes with our sort of lineage. Other lineages may be as happy as clams with their ration of simplicity. 3. The unity of design space. The formation of different languages and of distinct species, and the proofs that both have been developed through a gradual process, are curiously the same. Charles Darwin, 1871, page 59. It will not have gone unnoticed that my examples in this chapter have wandered back and forth between the domain of organisms or biological design on the one hand, and the domain of human artifacts, books, problem solved, and engineering triumphs on the other. This was by design, not accident, of course. It was to help set the stage for and provide lots of ammunition for a central salvo. There is only one design space, and everything actual in it is united with everything else. And I hardly need add that it was Darwin who taught us this, whether he quite realized it or not. Now, I want to go back over the ground we have covered, highlighting the evidence for this claim, and drawing out a few more implications of it, and grounds for believing it. The similarities and continuities are of tremendous importance, I think, but in later chapters I will also point to some important dissimilarities between the human-made portions of the designed world and the portions that were created without benefit of the sort of locally concentrated, foresighted intelligence we human artificers bring to a problem. We noted at the outset that the Library of Mendel, in the form of printed volumes of the letters A, C, G, T, is contained within the Library of Babel. But we should also note that at least a very large portion of the Library of Babel, what portion? Listen to chapter 15, is in turn contained in the Library of Mendel, because we are in the Library of Mendel. Our genomes are, and so are the genomes of all the life forms our lives depend on. The Library of Babel describes one aspect of our extended phenotype, Dawkins, 1982. That is, in the same way that spiders make webs and beavers make dams, we make, among many other things, books. You can't assess the spider's genome for viability without a consideration of the web that is part of the normal equipment of the spider. And you can't assess the viability of our genomes, not any longer you can't, without recognizing that we are a species with culture, a representative part of which is in the form of books. We are not just designed, we are designers. And all our talents as designers and our products must emerge non-miraculously from the blind, mechanical processes of Darwinian mechanisms of one sort or another. How many cranes on top of cranes does it take to get from the early design explorations of prokaryotic lineages to the mathematical investigations of Oxford dons? That is the question posed by Darwinian thinking. The resistance comes from those who think there must be some discontinuity somewhere, some skyhooks, or moments of special creation, or some other sort of miracles, between the prokaryotes and the finest treasures in our libraries. There may be. That will be a question we will look at in many different ways in the rest of the audiobook. But we have already seen a variety of deep parallels, instances in which the very same principles, The very same strategies of analysis or inference apply in both domains. There are many more where they came from. Consider, for instance, Darwin's pioneering use of a certain sort of historical inference. As Stephen Jay Gould has stressed, for example, 1977A, 1980A, it is the imperfections, the curious fallings short of what would seem to be perfect design, that are the best evidence for a historical process of descent with modification. They are the best evidence of copying, instead of independent reinventing, of the design in question. We can now see better why this is such good evidence. The odds against two independent processes arriving at the same region of design space are vast, unless the design element in question is obviously right, a forced move in design space. Perfection will be independently hit upon again and again, especially if it is obvious. It is the idiosyncratic versions of near perfection that are a dead giveaway of copying. In evolutionary theory, such traits are called homologies, traits that are similar not because they have to be for functional reasons, but because of copying. The biologist Mark Ridley observes, "Many of what are often presented as separate arguments for evolution reduce to the general form of the argument from homology," and he boils the argument down to its essence. The ear bones of mammals are an example of a homology. They are homologous with some of the jaw bones of reptiles. The ear bones of mammals did not have to be formed from the same bones as form the jaw of reptiles, but in fact they are. The fact that species share homologies is an argument for evolution. For if they had been created separately, there would be no reason why they should show homologous similarities. Mark Ridley, 1985, page 9. This is how it is in the biosphere, and also how it is in the cultural sphere of plagiarism, industrial espionage, and the honest work of recension of texts. Here is a curious historical coincidence. While Darwin was fighting his way clear to an understanding of this characteristically Darwinian mode of inference, some of his fellow Victorians, in England and especially in Germany, had already perfected the same bold, ingenious strategy of historical inference in the domain of paleography or philology. I have several times alluded to the works of Plato in this audiobook, but it is a miracle that Plato's work survives for us to read today in any version at all. All the texts of his dialogues were essentially lost for over 1,000 years. When they reemerged at the dawn of the Renaissance in the form of various tattered, dubious, partial copies of copies of copies from who knows where, this set in motion 500 years of painstaking scholarship, intended to purify the text and establish a proper informational link with the original sources, which, of course, would have been in Plato's own hand, or the hand of the scribe to whom he dictated. The originals had presumably long since turned to dust. Today there are some fragments of papyrus with Platonic text on them, and these bits of text may be roughly contemporaneous with Plato himself, but they have played no important role in the scholarship, having been uncovered quite recently. The task that faced the scholars was daunting. There were obviously many corruptions in the various non-extinct copies, called witnesses, and these corruptions or errors had to be fixed. But there were also many puzzling or exciting passages of dubious authenticity, and no way of asking the author which were which. How could they be properly distinguished? The corruptions could be more or less rank-ordered in obviousness: 1, typographical errors; 2, grammatical errors; 3, stupid or otherwise baffling expressions; or 4, bits that were just not stylistically or doctrinally like the rest of Plato. By Darwin's day, The philologists, who devoted their entire professional lives to recreating the genealogy of their witnesses, had not only developed elaborate and, for their day, rigorous methods of comparison, but had succeeded in extrapolating whole lineages of copies, and deduced many curious facts about the historical circumstances of their birth, reproduction, and eventual death. By an analysis of the patterns of shared and unshared errors in the existing documents, the carefully preserved parchment treasures in the Bodleian Library at Oxford and Paris, in the Vienna National Bibliotheque, in the Vatican, and elsewhere, they were able to deduce hypotheses about how many different copyings there had to have been, roughly when and where some of these must have been made, and which witnesses had relatively recent shared ancestors, and which did not. Sometimes the deductive boldness of their work is the equal of anything in Darwin. A particular group of manuscript errors, uncorrected and recopied in all the descendants in a particular lineage, was almost certainly due to the fact that the scribe who took the dictation did not pronounce Greek the same way the reader did, and consequently misheard a particular phoneme on many occasions. Such clues, together with evidence from other sources on the history of the Greek language, might even suggest to the scholars which monastery on which Greek island or mountaintop in which century must have been the scene for the creation of this set of mutations, even though the actual parchment document created then and there has long since succumbed to the second law of thermodynamics and turned to dust. Did Darwin ever learn anything from the philologists? Did any philologists recognize that Darwin had reinvented one of their wheels? Nietzsche was himself one of these stupendously erudite students of the ancient texts, and he was one of many German thinkers who were swept up in the Darwin boom, but so far as I know, he never noticed a kinship between Darwin's method and that of his colleagues. Darwin himself was struck in later years by the curious similarity between his arguments and those of the philologists studying the genealogy of languages, not, as in the case of the Plato scholars, the genealogy of specific texts. In The Descent of Man, 1871, page 59, he pointed explicitly to their shared use of the distinction between homologies and analogies that could be due to convergent evolution. We find in distinct languages striking homologies due to community of descent, and analogies due to a similar process of formation. Imperfections or